Hey everybody, this is Ben dropping you a quick note. Our editors have been working hard to get episodes finished to release on schedule with the reading of the week. Our hope is that listeners will have the chance to engage with the content and share meaningful ideas in their circles of family, friends, and church. In order to meet this goal, this episode has been released with minimal editing. We are looking for additional volunteers to join the team and help with editing, social media management, and content creation. If you are interested, please reach out to us on Facebook or email latterdaypeacestudies@gmail.com. You can also donate to the project, helping us cover the costs of things like website hosting and podcast platform fees. Donations can be made through PayPal by going to our website, latterdaypeacestudies.org, clicking Get Involved, and scrolling down to the donate box. Thanks so much to all who have helped out and donated over the years. We are sincerely grateful. Latter-day Peace Studies is produced by peace-loving members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Any views expressed herein are not to be taken as official positions of the Church or its authorities.
Latter-day Peace Studies presents Come Follow Me. I'm Christopher Hurtado.
And I'm Ben Peterson.
Thank you for joining us as we discuss this week's reading of Come Follow Me as outlined by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Our hope is that as we discuss the scriptures, we will come to a more perfect understanding through experiencing the atonement of Jesus Christ and find greater peace in our lives.
Welcome back to Latter-day Peace Studies. I'm your co-host, Ben Peterson.
And I'm your co-host, Christopher Hurtado. It's good to be with you, Ben.
Yeah. Today, we're going to be finishing the book of Acts, talking about chapters 22 through 28. As we were discussing pre-recording, we went over a few of the things that we thought were most interesting in these chapters here. Exclusively, we're focusing on Paul and what goes on with him. You've mentioned before, Christopher, you know, this says the Acts of the Apostles, but it is the majority of this is really the Acts of Paul, right?
That's right. Yeah.
So here we're going to cover what could be termed Paul's apology. He stands up before the people, kind of gives his defense, explanation, his testimony or witness, if you will. Right. And he does this several times throughout these chapters because he's brought before different people. Turns out we get different accounts, even from Paul's own mouth in Acts, of his vision. And so we have in the book of Acts itself, three accounts of Paul's vision, and they differ in their details.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah. I don't know that they're insignificant differences either. You know, we'll talk about that.
Now, they're not all three in this week's reading, right?
That's correct. Two of them are in this reading, and the first one is back in chapter 9. Now, the one in chapter 9 is really a telling of the author of the book of Acts, so to speak, right? Telling about in third person, whereas these ones are Paul speaking in the first person telling. But even, like I said, the ones from his mouth in here differ. So you would think a book together as Acts, there would be some continuity, consistency in those accounts, and there's not as much as I would have thought. So,
yeah, that brings up an interesting question. Yeah, why wouldn't the author of this book, what's the word, Ben?
Standardize?
Correlate, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
In LDS terms, or correlate these stories, right? And so we have a very similar occurrence with the prophet Joseph Smith and his stories of his first vision, so-called, right?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, so what do you think, Ben? What do you make of this?
Well, several things could be going on. One, the author could just be recording what Paul is actually saying, right? These could actually have been the words of Paul himself, or he could be compiling just different accounts from different people, as we've seen in other scriptures. If you remember, and obviously I don't think this is the same process, but there could be something similar going on here. Back in the Old Testament, when we talked about the documentary hypothesis, you have these different accounts, and then when they're compiled, you have somebody who wants to preserve all of these things, doesn't want to lose any of it, right? And so they weave the narrative together such that all of those are preserved, even if there's some contradictions between the different accounts of the stories. And so it's possible here that the author wants to preserve all these accounts. And so as he's giving this narrative, he wants to include them at different times, even if they are slightly different accounts.
Yeah, you know, since you mentioned, you know, going all the way back to the Hebrew Bible, right? We talked about the difference in Greek and Hebrew ways of thought. And of course, that we've also talked about the tradition in Judaism of arguing over the scriptures, right? And when I say arguing, I mean, it's not like anybody's feelings have to be hurt. You know, I'm the son of a New Yorker, and we argue to argue, right? I'm a philosopher, too. We argue to argue. We don't, it's not personal, right? It's about ideas. And so there's this tradition of having all of the different interpretations in competition with each other, right? In a healthy competition, the kind of thing that we say we want from our government, right? Where it's funny because people talk about, you know, nothing's getting done in Congress. Well, that may be a good thing, right? Let's keep things, let's slow things down and have people arguing the ideas. So there's a little bit of that as that's part of the tradition that's baked into this. And then of course, there's the Greek and Hebrew thought patterns, which, you know, in general terms, right? The Greek thinking is either or. Right? Where and the Hebrew thinking is more both and.
Sure.
And that's to summarize it, right? To maybe oversimplify it. But I think that it's a good way to epitomize the ideas, at least.
Yeah. And argue could be a term. Maybe in this context, debate might be a way to term it, because we're not talking about necessarily who's right and who's wrong. We're presenting the different perspectives so that we can arrive at something that is closer to the truth or closer to a better understanding of the situation, right?
Ben, that reminds me of the way I would read the scriptures, you know, as I was studying scriptures before I studied Greek, right? I looked at being bilingual in English and Spanish at the time, you know, even as a boy, I would read the English and the Spanish knowing that I'm reading translations and that neither one of them is it. Right? Neither one of these is the Greek. And I sort of wanted to triangulate, right? I knew the truth wasn't either or, it was somewhere in between.
Yeah, yeah. And that's possibly what you could do with these different accounts, right? You could say none of these accounts is it, but they all give a little bit different perspective or flavor to it. And we can kind of start understanding maybe a little better what it was by seeing the different accounts.
Ben, isn't another possibility this idea that we've expressed when it comes to Joseph Smith too, that because the audience is different, the telling is different?
Yeah, and that's another, I think, very legitimate way to go with this, is that these different accounts are given to different audiences. And so the way they're presented is going to be different, because to one audience, you may bring up certain details that are more relevant to them than others, or you may omit certain details that might be detracting from the overall point and purpose of the story, of the narrative that you're trying to get across. And so you may not say, oh, it was, you know, Jesus himself that said this to me. You may say in the story, well, I was told to go talk to this man, and then this man told me what to say, right? Just depending on the audience that you're getting after.
Any other possibilities come to mind?
Well, one of the other ones in the context, like you said, Christopher, you brought up Joseph Smith and the different first vision accounts. The other thing that is going on there, pretty obviously, at least with Joseph Smith, is that these aren't just given to different audiences. They're given at different times of his life. And so the actual context of when they're delivered, not just different audiences, but he's a different person when he's giving these accounts. And so his understanding of his original experiences has changed over time. And so it's also possible that Paul and his understanding and view of his original experience, which is in some sense would have been ineffable, right, has changed over time. And he is going to express it differently because his understanding is different from time to time. Again, in this narrative, his two accounts are given almost back to back. But that doesn't mean that, like, in reality, these two accounts were given back to back. That's just part of how this narrative flows, right?
You know, that brings to mind some things that I've been exploring in my reading, Ben, and that I want to have in mind as I continue reading through the New Testament, right? That are themes that I pay attention to in literature, right? Whether in novels or in memoirs. And those are the themes of memory and identity.
Mm. Yeah, memory is a tricky thing. Right. I think we talked about this in the Old Testament as well, bringing up some points that every time, memories are not read-only. Okay. Like every time we access a memory, it changes somewhat. I speak about it sort of in computer information terms, because that's you know, my profession, but, you know, in computers, you have data where you can say, this is read-only, and it's always going to stay the same. But, you know, our brains, our neurons aren't the same way. Every time something is accessed, it's changed somewhat. And so you don't just have some memory that's static.
That makes things interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Well, should we go into the first speech here then? So right off the bat, we get mention of Gamaliel. I just wanted to point out, right, this is, I think we talked about him earlier. He's Paul's teacher. He's a very famous rabbi, right? One of the most famous after Hillel, I guess. Just wanted to mention him.
Yeah, so he's a Pharisee. Yeah.
Yeah, so that's important too, right? Yeah, he's a Pharisee. And so Paul is a Pharisee. That's how he was trained. And by the way, that's actually getting ahead of, remember where we left off last time, Ben, is Paul was about to address these people in Hebrew.
Yeah.
And that shows up right here at the beginning where it's actually in Aramaic, right? So in the Hebrew language, as the NRSV has it, means in Aramaic.
Yeah, it's interesting because at the end of chapter 21, at least in the NRSV translation, it says in the Hebrew language, which I kind of take to mean the language of the Hebrews. You know, it would be almost like saying, you know, the American language. It's like, well, the American language is English, right? But it's just the way it says. So in the Hebrew language. But then when we get to verse 2 of chapter 22, it doesn't say in the Hebrew language. It just says in Hebrew. But, you know, what's meant by that is Aramaic, because the people aren't speaking Hebrew as their common tongue, as their vernacular language, right?
Right. And so in verse 4, we get the Christianity called the Way. Right? That's still happening. You see, this reminds me of a conversation we had before we started recording, Ben, about periodicity, right? So the idea that, you know, that historical periods don't actually begin and end on certain dates, right? It's historians talk about things that way, but it's not like everybody got the memo that the Renaissance had started.
Yeah.
In fact, Jacob Burckhardt made up the Renaissance and there were no dark ages is another way to look at it. And we've already mentioned the connection, well, we didn't mention in connection with the Dark Ages, but there is a connection between that, those ideas of the Dark Ages and the Renaissance, and the Great Apostasy narrative, right? They're all connected. And so we don't really have a memo yet that Christianity is called Christianity, and we keep getting the Way and, you know, Christianity, and what else do we get?
So we also get, like, the Nazarenes. Sometimes, like, he's right, called a Nazarene here, follower of the Nazarene. So there are different ways of referring to it.
Yeah, and it's interesting because in the Islamic tradition, the earliest Christian Muslim encounters, and I think even in Quran, you have the Nasara, right? The Nazarenes, right? Which is different from Masihin, who are the Messianists, right? So you get these different names for Christianity, even in the Islamic tradition, as things develop.
Yeah. I wonder if you could say messianics. I don't know if that's a word.
I don't think that's a word.
Well, I made it up.
And so, yeah, and we're good at that, Ben. You know, I think once you know a few languages, you start to know how to sort of make up words too, right? You just can follow the roots and patterns and whatever. So now we have, I think this, there are a few things in this week's reading that made me chuckle. And I just thought I'd share that, right? So here in verse 6, about noon, a great light from heaven suddenly shone about me. Okay, I get that it says suddenly, but about noon, a great light from heaven shone about. Yeah, that's the sun, right?
It's high noon, sun, right? It's straight up. Yeah,
exactly. And it's fun because he sees that, and then he hears a voice. Well, actually, it's funny because it says he sees. What doesn't it say? He sees something, but then it's about hearing, not about seeing, right? That's the funny thing. And the people around him don't see or hear anything, except for they see the sun, right?
Yeah. The idea, I think, here is that he's blinded by the light in some way, you know, so he kind of loses his sense of sight for a time. Like we were saying, there's these three different accounts. In verse 9 here, it says, those who were with me saw the light, but did not hear the voice. But back in chapter 9, verse 7, where we get the first of this account, right? It says that the companions that were with him did hear the voice, but saw no one.
And that's a pretty significant difference.
That is a significant difference, I think. Yeah. So did they hear it or did they not? You know, were they witnesses to the event in terms of hearing what was actually said, or did they not? So.
Right. And if he told them what he experienced, does that count as witnessing? You know, do you see what I mean? Yeah. Like that could be another way of reading it. So in verse 12, we get Ananias. This is fun for me too, because I actually, you know, I've been to the place where Paul, well, okay. This is the place where it's said that Paul, where Jesus appeared to Paul on the road to Damascus. So I did leave Damascus where I was living, and I went out on the road and I found the place, and there's a church there, of course.
Sure, yeah.
And I've also been to Ananias' house here in verse 12, right? That's in Damascus in the old city, and I've walked down the street called Straight to get there, you know? So this is kind of fun for me. Then we have being baptized in verse 16 to wash your sins away. We did cover that, right? We talked about this idea of washing sins away, how it's not clear what baptism is when it first shows up, and now we're getting this idea. It shows up earlier in Acts in chapter 2, verse 38.
So I think in a literal sense, we can say Paul's sight was restored, but symbolically, something's going on here, right? His spiritual sight was restored so he could see what was right in front of him, but he didn't understand. That is the way, right? Because he's not able to make his way. Somebody has to guide him into the city. And then his eyes are open once he gets to Ananias, and now he can see the way, right? And I just think it was interesting in light of following Christ the way, that now that Paul's eyes are open, he can see the way, and he doesn't have to be led by somebody anymore.
I like that. Yeah. So then he goes to the temple in Jerusalem and he's praying, and he falls into a trance. Has that ever happened to you, Ben? So he falls into a trance,
not
but
exactly.
It tells us something, right? Not exactly, right? Did you fall into a deep sleep, Ben?
I have definitely fallen asleep while praying. That's true.
Have you? So he goes in the temple and he's praying. He falls into a trance and he saw Jesus. This is the one I was thinking of, Ben. He saw Jesus saying to him. Hmm. What does that mean? He saw Jesus saying. You hear Jesus saying. You don't see.
Yeah.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting. He saw Jesus saying to him. But that's how I think we're getting a sense of someone trying to describe an epiphany, right?
Yeah.
This theophany in words. And it doesn't fit in words. And so you say things like, you saw Jesus saying to you.
I think that's where I would go with it too. You know, you have this interesting phenomena called synesthesia, where people hear colors, right? And see tastes, stuff like that, where their senses are mixed up. And so this may be this interesting rhetorical device somebody's using, where they mix up the senses to say, look, it wasn't exactly seeing, it wasn't exactly hearing, it was something like both. I don't know how else to describe it, right? And I think that is an interesting way of putting it.
And it's something that happens with visions or with spiritual experiences, as we call them. It happens with psychedelics too, Ben.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's another common experience with psychedelics. The experiences have been compared, right? The psychedelic and the religious experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think you and I went into, back in the Old Testament, we went into the acacia tree and the stoned ape theory. I think we talked about these things.
Oh yeah, I think that's a fascinating theory. I don't know everything to make of it, but there might be something there.
It is interesting. And I recently read a book on the Eleusinian Mysteries that was not taken as seriously earlier as it is now by scholars in mm-hmm. terms of the use of mushrooms in the Eleusinian mystery cult, right?
Yeah. So at this point, you know, Paul is in the temple and he's having this vision. He seems to be concerned, and he even is having this conversation, right, with Jesus. He's concerned that the Jewish Christians aren't going to accept him because he persecuted them. Right. So he's, you know, I held their coats while they were killed. And so Jesus says to him, don't worry about that. You're going to go far away to the Gentiles. And this is another part that I chuckle a little bit about, because immediately what Paul does is he goes to the synagogues and starts preaching to the Jews. He just can't stay away from those synagogues, you know.
Like a dog to his vomit, right?
Yeah.
You know, I thought it was interesting in verse 22 that the crowd calls for his execution, a lot like in Jesus's. So there are a lot of parallels when it comes to the stories in this week's reading between the appearance of Paul before Agrippa and even in this situation in Jerusalem, right, with the Sanhedrin, I guess, and between the appearance of Jesus before Pilate, right? So we get these parallels between Jesus appearing before Pilate and Paul appearing before Agrippa. And this is one of them, right? The idea that the crowd would call for their execution in both cases. And so I think these stories are meant to look alike. That's the point of telling these stories in this way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And they give us, it's a lot like when Brigham Young becomes the next prophet, right? There are stories just like this after, when I say becomes the next prophet, I mean after Joseph Smith's death, right? So here we have the death of Jesus. Who's going to succeed him, right? And so this story, just like the one that makes, and I'm telling these backwards, right? This is an anachronistic way to talk about it. But these two stories are very similar, right? The idea that we have to show somehow that the successor is in some sense the same as or similar to the original.
Yeah, that there are characteristics of the original that are the successor he carries forward.
And at a poetic level, you know what I mean, Ben? I mean, I'm not seeing arguments made here. This is rhetoric. So rhetoric is aesthetic, right? It's not about, it's not a metaphysical or epistemological argument. It's not an argument at all. It's like poetry, right? It's supposed to speak to your, directly to your heart, to your imagination, to your, let's say, spiritual sensibilities, right? It's not an argument. It's telling a story that's going to make you feel that this successor is somehow connected to the original, the one that he's succeeding.
Yeah, and that happens in the narrative of Paul. But, you know, like you said, Paul himself gives more rhetorical or even logical and metaphysical arguments when he's giving his defense. But then when we get to the letters of Paul, you know, he really gets into that sort of rhetoric.
Speaking of rhetoric, we get here at the end of this chapter that Paul, because he is a Roman citizen by birth, is therefore more Roman.
Yeah.
He's more Roman than the other guy who had to buy his citizenship.
Yeah.
Right. But of course, Paul is from a Jewish family. So somebody bought the citizenship. If not Paul, then Paul's parents or their parents.
Uh-huh. Yeah. He kind of one-ups the other guy here.
Right.
So, well, I was born a Roman citizen.
You had to buy your citizenship.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, that certainly could have been the case. He was born a Roman citizen. The point, I think, of including it here fits in with the overall, one of the overall purposes of the book of Acts, to show that Christianity is compatible with Roman life. You can be a good Roman and be a Christian, because Paul is, right? And he's also a good Jew, by the way. He's a perfect Jew, right? He comes up with this later.
And in that respect, you know, in that regard, we cannot forget to, at the end of this, right, when we don't find out what happens to Paul, uh-huh, we need to talk about that.
Yeah, it's a glaring omission, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So I think that brings us to chapter 23, Ben.
Yes.
Yeah, so in the beginning of this chapter, Ben, we have in verses 6 through 8 that Paul is among Sadducees and Pharisees, right? Mm-hmm. There in the council. And so he makes an appeal. It's kind of an interesting approach that he takes, right? That he makes an appeal to the Pharisees and gets them to agree with him on the things that, well, Christianity now being Pauline, at least, if not before, that are Pharisaical, right? That any Pharisee could agree with, but the Sadducees could not, right? There are some specific things, resurrection, angels, spirits, right? The Pharisees acknowledge all three of these things, and that's right there in verse 7, but not the Sadducees.
Yeah, this is very clever politics on Paul's part, right? This is divide and conquer. So it's like they're supposed to be united against him, but he says, hey, the reason I'm being persecuted is because I believe in resurrection. And so then that starts this argument between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And, you know, they kind of ignore Paul, I guess, in some ways after this even.
You know, as we've studied, you know, before we're here on the mic talking about this, but even as we talk about it, I see more and more. I saw it when I was studying. I, you know, we talked about it pre-show, but I just see more and more how clever these narratives are. You know, they're really well-crafted narratives. And so that actually brings me back in my mind, just I want to touch again on the three different stories. And I don't have answers, right? And maybe we don't need answers, meaning that, well, okay, we gave some answers why there would be three different stories, right? Maybe we don't need to know which one is the one, because we've already talked about this, right? Yeah. That there isn't necessarily the one, right, anymore with this narrative than with the first vision narrative.
Here in verse 12, there's a reference to the Jews, right? And this is still just in Greek eudaioi, which we've talked about multiple times in the Gospels, really could mean, as it's translated, the Jews, but it means Judeans or Judeans. And so, again, we're talking about the leaders, those in authority here. We're not talking about the Jewish people in general, obviously, because Paul is a Jew in that sense.
And so are the Christians, right?
Yeah, so were most of the Christians at this point?
Yeah, that's right. Not all of them. Yeah, but most.
And so the Iudaioi, it says that they joined this conspiracy against Paul. And that does seem to be a bit of a theme here. Again, at the end of the book, the omission of how Paul dies kind of comes back to this point, that some of the focus here is on the leadership of the Jews being the main problem. In fact, the Romans are always shown, almost always, as far as I can remember here, shown in a good light, right? They're trying to help Paul. They don't understand what all this, you know, hubbub is about, so to speak. And they're like, no, Paul's fine. There's no problem here. And it's just these authority figures, these religious authority figures, they're the problem, right?
Yeah. And again, not the Jews, but the religious authorities among the Jews, and in particular the Judeans. And so it's interesting too, because you have these stock characters, as we mentioned last time, right? That's part of the narrative here is, again, you've mentioned Ben already. We've mentioned a couple of times. We don't find out what happens to Paul. Well, I'm just going to tell you, he gets killed by who? The Romans. So we cannot talk about that in this book, right? We have to leave that out because the Jews are the bad guys. The Iudaioi, I should say, right? They're the bad guys, not the Romans.
Yeah. So if you end with the Romans killing him, then it kind of upsets the one of the principal points of this whole narrative. Yeah.
Yeah. So we may not know what the purpose or audience or any of these questions about Acts, but we can see what's going on here, right? We can see and so get some clues. Again, this is really about the compatibility of being Roman and Christian, I think. Certainly for Paul, it's the compatibility of in this particular part here, right, about being Pharisee and Christian. No problem, right? Sadducee, that's a different story. You don't believe in resurrection? That's a problem because the whole renegotiation of the entire Old Testament now is Jesus was resurrected and that's a thing, right? That's a key thing for Christianity. So if you're a Sadducee and you didn't have a belief in resurrection, as many Jews didn't necessarily, right, then this doesn't work for you. But if you're a Pharisee, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So isn't that interesting? You know, we have sort of grouped the Pharisees and the Sadducees together as Latter-day Saints, I mean, and they're sort of both wrong. And yet it looks like being Christian is a lot like being a Pharisee, right? In some sense.
Well, I remember my New Testament professor at BYU he wrote a lot about Pharisees, and he had a book, or maybe it was an article, I don't remember. And his article was, the Pharisees were the good guys. Right. That was his whole point, was that, you know, we talk about things and we use this word pharisaical all the time and all this. But actually, when you go back and read the accounts, the gospel writers and, you know, the writers of Acts, they did not view the Pharisees in as much a negative light as we sometimes take. Right. They definitely didn't like the Sadducees that much.
That's right. Yeah. And to bring a little more nuance to the conversation, but, you know, the thing that we mean by Pharisaical isn't about this stuff. Yes. This stuff, these are common beliefs, right, between Pharisees and Christians. The stuff that we call Pharisaical is, I think, contrasting Jesus, the figure of Jesus, and the way that he treated people not according to the rules, right? And then those Pharisees who are following the rules, everything by the book,
right,
crossing the T's, dotting the I's, and living by the, as we call it, by the letter of the law, not by the spirit. And Jesus is this figure that gives us the spirit of the law, right? This idea of, I think, you know, it's a beautiful idea. And it reminds me in the Islamic tradition of maqasid al-sharia, right? The purposes and intents of the law that are studied by some Islamic scholars, right? That would tell us what priority to give to one law over another, right? If they come into conflict, or whether the law should be suspended entirely, right? As in, for example, in the case of famine, you wouldn't have what are called had punishments in Islam, so that, you know, no one should have their hand cut off, like Jean Valjean, speaking figuratively, of course, which, by the way, the cutting off of hands doesn't have to be literal. It can also be figurative in the same way, like the caliph's brother who stole from the treasury and was exiled. Well, now his hand is cut off from the treasury, right? So these kind of, this idea of putting the people above the laws themselves, right? Because the laws are for the people, like Jesus says, the Sabbath is for humans, not the other way around.
Right. At one point, when they're going to take Paul and escort him over, the Romans call for something like 470 soldiers to escort him.
Oh, yeah.
But 470 definitely seems hyperbolic. This would be an exaggeration to emphasize the threat against Paul's life, right? So, like, they're trying to demonstrate that Paul truly is in danger. There really is a conspiracy. They're really out to get him, right? It's not paranoia if they're really out to get you, right?
That's right.
Yeah, there's another point in here where it talks about there being, you know, 200 and something people on the ship. And that also seems like a bit of an exaggeration as well. So, but I did read as well in a footnote that the number of people on the ship is totally possible. Yeah. But
yeah,
that is less likely to be an exaggeration than this 470 number. Yeah.
That's right. And you do have, again, the variants in the manuscripts, right, mm-hmm. that support this possibility. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ben, before we go to 24, there's something I meant to bring up, which is the, well, it's not whited sepulchres, but I think it's an equivalent. And that's in verse 3, where we get whitewashed walls in the NRSV translation. This, again, it's like the whited sepulchres, right? It's calling someone, it's a metaphor. It's something like a veneer is what we would call it today, right? That it's someone who hides their moral defects, as Amy Jo Levine has it, behind a seemingly proper demeanor or authority, right? So it's a veneer, a whitewash, as it were.
Yeah, we do use that term. They whitewashed it, meaning they covered up something with just like a cheap facade, right? It's a facade.
Right. And then, you know, we mentioned the differences between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. I wanted to mention too that you and I both actually read about this straight from Josephus, right? Like you can read Josephus, who's a contemporary historian who's distinguishing between Sadducees and Pharisees. And by the way, calling them both sects, and the term that's being translated sect is heresis, right? Which is where we get heresy from, because heresis actually means choice. And so choice in this context, when it comes to going up against orthodoxy and having your own choice, this means you're choosing for yourself something other than what is the orthodoxy, which of course at this point, I was going to say there's no orthodoxy. It just, we have Jacobite Christianity, we have Pauline Christianity. Somebody has to win. And I guess a spoiler would be Paul wins, right? And we're going to have Pauline Christianity.
I feel like using the word flavor in that case. These are different flavors.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's the way we talk about it, right? In the colloquial language, right? Yeah. In our colloquial language, yeah. By the way, you know, we have another, really this picture of these violent Jews, right? They're going to tear Paul to pieces in verse 10. It seems really extreme, right? I don't think I can take these things, you know, given these stock characters and the persecution of Paul in this way, I don't think I can take it as sort of historical, you know what right. I mean?
This is stylized to show.
It is, it's highly stylized.
Paul is in danger, and what's going to happen is the Romans are going to protect him from, you know, those that are out for his blood, so to speak, right?
Yeah. So there's one more thing here with the violence of the Jews, right, as they're depicted here, that they make this refusal to eat or drink part of their oath, right? And so this shows this intense hatred of Paul, is how Amy Jo Levine puts it, proposing this act that even violates biblical law and is actually punishable by death, right, according to Numbers 35, 20 through 21.
Well, Paul points this out when he says, "I'm of clear conscience," and then they strike him, right? And he says, you know, you're supposed to be a judge of the law, and then you strike me against the law.
So that's right.
There's multiple times in here where it's demonstrated that they're violating their own rules, right? They're so strict about the rules that they end up violating them. And that's very on par with how the Gospels treated Jesus's interactions with them as well.
Well, that would make them hypocrites. That's a word we get from Jesus, right?
Yeah.
Another, by the way, there's a whole class of people in the Quran called hypocrites, right? This is a thing, right? To have these people who are hypocrites, who are whitewashed, who are whited sepulchres, right? So we have finally in verse 29, another similarity between Paul before Agrippa and Jesus before Pilate, which is you have several figures who are announcing the innocence of the man on trial, right? And yet there'll be a call for his execution from the crowd.
Yeah, the Romans don't seem to get why the Jews are so upset here, right? They're like, we don't really get it. It's some particularity, some nuance of your law. We don't understand why it makes you so upset. We don't see why you're calling for his blood. You know, for us, it's like, if he's preaching against Rome or, you know, sedition or not paying his taxes, you know, yeah, we'll kill him. But if he's, you know, if he's like just saying God is a little different than you think, we don't get it. We don't understand why you are so upset about this.
What's the big deal?
Yeah, what's the big deal? So,
well, that brings us to chapter 24.
Yeah. So Paul's having his hearings. You know, I call these hearings because I don't know that anything is being decided in terms of judgment. At least he ultimately appeals to Caesar, right? That's the idea. But there's a guy named Tertullus who is acting as the accuser in Paul's hearing before the governor Felix. I just thought that was interesting to point out here, right? So Tertullus is acting as the accuser. He's the Satan.
The Satan.
Right? He's the Satan in this trial. So it would be an interesting study to just go through and see how is Tertullus treating Paul, and to say, okay, he's acting in that office, you know, as the Satan. And, yeah. And you can kind of pull out of that those characteristics, those archetypes that we might experience or, you know, within our life and be able to identify when someone or when we or when a part of us is acting that way, right?
Yeah, so now we're not looking at a hearing of, in front of Jews, right? In front of the Sanhedrin, but this is a Roman thing, right?
Yeah.
So now we see, as you pointed out, Ben, the kind of thing that would concern the Romans. And Acts 24:5 gave me a chuckle. Here's the accusation, right? We have in fact found this man a pestilent fellow, an agitator among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes.
Yeah.
I say guilty as charged, Ben.
Yeah, the Romans are like, okay.
Yeah, that's all I've got, Ben.
You know, I think to that point, those are the similar accusations that are leveled against Jesus, right? These are accusations veiled as they may be of sedition, but the only real accusation that would be taken seriously in a Roman court. And so that's why they're kind of harping on that point. You know, the Romans are examining this as they ask more and more questions. They realize that the nuance is really about Jewish law, but the Jews are like saying, no, 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 you don't get it. At the heart of this is sedition against Rome. And that's what you're not seeing. And they don't see it, right? The Romans don't see that being the case.
Yeah.
As Paul sort of is allowed to speak here and gives his defense, he seems to downplay the distinctiveness of the way or of what we might call Christianity from that of Judaism in general. And you know, we're looking back 2,000 years of these things being divergent. But, you know, within the people's experience of the time, the early followers of the way didn't see themselves as not Jews anymore, right? This was just a part of their religious experience. They didn't change religions. That's not how they felt about it. And so Paul seems to be kind of downplaying the difference there, saying, I'm just acting out my Judaism here. Why is this a problem? Right. And he even talks about how he went, you know, we talked about this in the previous podcast, that Paul actually does go to the temple and pays alms and offers sacrifices, does his rounds of purification, right? He pays for the other guy's haircuts. Remember that thing? So
that's right.
He's recounting that. He's saying, no, I'm just Jewish like everybody else. Like I did all of the things. And so, you know, he did this at the request of the apostles in Jerusalem so he could demonstrate that he was a pious Jew to the Jewish membership of the church.
Yeah. Ben, there's something I wanted to talk about in verse 15. You know, we've mentioned the idea that resurrection, in some sense, is a new idea at the time of Christ among the Pharisees. In another sense, there's more nuance to that. And I wanted you to go into that a little bit, Ben. So we have, of course, in verse 15, resurrection of both the righteous and the unrighteous. And we can compare that with Daniel 12:2, right? But I know you have more to say about this in terms of going back and picking up the thread of belief in the resurrection, as it were.
Yeah, and it can be kind of hard to get to the root of, like, and there's some nuance and complexity to it. But I would say it's difficult to find, at least scripturally, where the Jewish concept of resurrection comes into play.
At least in our canon,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, scripturally, in our canon, right? So we can see some hints of it. And you know, hint is probably not the right word. We can see in Ezekiel, for instance, we have this vision of that valley of bones, right? And then the bones are brought back together and resurrected. And the interpretation of that isn't always necessarily given as literal, as this is an actual, you know, literal resurrection of people. The vision is interpreted more within the Jewish context as being symbolic of the restoration of the people to their lands. But the very fact that it could be symbolic has to, the concept of resurrection has to exist first within the Jewish mind, within their conceptual framework, for it to work as a symbol. Right. You can't, you know, introduce a cross and say this is a symbol of Jesus until it's like, well, how is it a symbol of him? Well, then you have to go tell the story of the cross. Right. So there has to be a concept of resurrection as such for the story in Ezekiel to be symbolic in the first place.
Ben, isn't one of the ideas, you know, of where resurrection would come from? It's, you know, we've been promised this land and this progeny. And as a people, right? And a lot of people have died.
Yeah.
And they never saw that promise fulfilled. And so you have to come up with something like resurrection to answer to that.
And that could be, you know, you brought up Daniel. One of the concepts in Daniel, and this is later than Ezekiel, but one of the ideas that is brought up in Daniel about the resurrection, it assumes a belief in a resurrection. But what it says the resurrection is a time for some just and some unjust to be brought back to life. So here's the idea. There's really four groups of people. The first group of people are the righteous who got what they deserved in this life, right? That means they were good and then they got good return. And so when they die, they can just go on because everything was already restored to them the way it was supposed to be in this life.
So you mean without being resurrected?
Without being resurrected, because they don't need to be. Everything in this life happened the way it was supposed to, so they can just move on, right? Whatever moving on means. I don't know if that implies an afterlife or not. That's not the idea here.
So hold on. Who's saying moving on? Are you saying
moving on? I'm saying moving on. I'm just saying that they aren't resurrected. And then I'm saying maybe that means they move on. I don't know. That's not.
Or that could be it.
Yeah. Or that could be it. It's just not it's not considered in this framework, right?
Okay.
So the second group of people would be the wicked, or those who dealt unjustly, and that they got what they deserved in this life as well, right? So they have also been dealt with justly in this life. Everything happened the way it was supposed to for them based on what they did. So they don't need to be resurrected.
So they're also not resurrected.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Because this life was, you know, it's complete for them.
So this is where we get then the resurrection of the just and the unjust, right? The righteous and the unrighteous.
Yeah. And when we say the, I think the implication here is all, right? But in Daniel, the idea is that the only people who are resurrected are these two groups of people. One is the righteous who didn't get their just, what they deserved for being righteous.
Just desert?
Mm-hmm. And the wicked who didn't get what they deserved for being wicked. And so both also have to be resurrected so that they can be rewarded or punished according to what is needed for their actions in this life. Okay. And so that is what happens in Daniel, right? You don't have a universal resurrection. You have a resurrection of people who didn't get what they deserved, whether it was good or bad in this life.
What if we go back further, Ben? I think, you know, there's an idea that some may have picked up on in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, we call the Old Testament the Christian tradition. And that is the idea of Hades, right? Hades, well, it's not Hades, sorry. It's Sheol, right? It's like Hades.
Yeah.
So in Greek, we have Hades. In Hebrew tradition, we have Sheol, and it's about the same thing, right? And by the way, being the same thing means it's not like this idea that Christians, that we have of a resurrection, because it's not to do with the soul at all, right? So you have that you're it's sort of a bodily existence in shadows, right? Not the real, like we see in life, but just in shadows. Right, some kind of shadowy existence. And we see again, we've talked about this a lot, Ben, the descent of figures like Aeneas and Odysseus, right, into that realm. We have Isis and Osiris, right, into that realm of the dead, mm-hmm. where there's sort of a continued existence, but not really a soul. And by the way, one of the things that makes this, you're saying how complicated this is, right? One of the most difficult books I've ever read, Ben, and you know, I've been reading difficult books for a long time, right? I'm a philosopher, you know, is this book on, it's A Brief History of the Soul. Mm. I mean, it just covers from antiquity, you know, through, I can't remember if it goes beyond Descartes or if I just lost interest after that, but I did finish the book, right? But I find the ancient ideas more interesting. But the point is, where is the soul? Right? These are real conversations that philosophers have been having. If there's a soul, well, what is that? Where is it? Is it, you know, if I cut off my foot, did I cut off part of my soul? Or does it retreat into the rest of my body? Or is that even how it works, right? There are these kind of questions. So even if, you know, even those of us who we have it all figured out, we don't.
Right.
Right.
Well, and something is a little different going on here with Paul when he's preaching about the resurrection, because here he does seem to be talking about a universal resurrection, right? No longer are there four groups of people. There's just two groups of people. Everybody's resurrected and you're either, you know, just or unjust. Where this idea, you know, comes into play, whether this is an idea of Paul that came to being when he became Christian, or whether this is something that grew more closely out of, you know, the Pharisaical tradition, it's not clear to me. But in any case, this is where Paul is right now, right? And this is where Christianity goes, a universal resurrection.
Yeah, it's the same question we had back when baptism shows up. Where does this come from?
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
The text is telling us that it's happening and what it means, but really, why? Since when? Right? And we went into the history of mikvah and we talked about that a lot, right? But it's still not 100% clear, right? These things sort of develop. And there's a development in theology, right? Again, we've been talking about, we've been mentioning, and we'll go into this more when we introduce Paul's letters, the great apostasy narrative, right? How that's not really held anymore. Maybe this hasn't caught up with the lay Latter-day Saint, right? But among scholars, even among Latter-day Saint scholars, it's just not the thing that it was thought to be or said to be, right?
The approach is changing for sure. Yeah.
Right. The approach has really changed.
You know, this goes back to your point that you were making at the beginning about history and dates of things happening, right? That they don't necessarily, something doesn't start on a certain date, right?
Right.
And it's not like we can point back and say baptism started on this date. It's an evolution of a concept within a community and people, and it comes to be in a certain way. And so here we can point to a verse where it's like, well, this is the first time that this is mentioned in scripture. But all that means is that it's been, you know, happening and discussed for a long time before it got written down right here, right?
That's right, yeah. I like the idea too, the way you put it. You know, it made me think of the atom, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And that may be because I just saw Oppenheimer for the second time. But, you know, we've had the concept of the atom since, well, Democritus, right? Yeah. In ancient Greece. But what we mean by atom, in some sense, has changed over time. The concept has developed, right? It's still, well, okay, it was supposed to be the smallest, well, see, that's the thing is, what do you call it, right? Now we say particle, right? The smallest particle of matter.
But it turns out that there's smaller things than atoms.
There's something smaller that we call particles, right? Smaller than atoms. But the concept is still the same. The idea that there's some irreducible part, right? And by the way, I think science is now pushing up against that, right?
Yeah.
There may not be anything like the atom, but we still have this concept around since more than 2,500 years ago.
Well, it's a useful concept within certain contexts for certain purposes, right? And so it's
That's
like,
right.
Yes, that atom does exist within a certain framework and for certain purposes. And that's the way that a lot of things are. It's like that concept fits and works within that framework and is true within that framework. But if you try to, you know, infinitely reduce it, you're going to run into problems.
Is that, in a sense, maybe how we can say the scriptures are true?
That tracks pretty well, yeah.
Yeah. And in that sense, they're always true, as I always say, right? The scriptures are always true, even if they're not historically accurate. Sometimes, sometimes we say the scriptures are always true, and sometimes they're even historically accurate, right? So we have Acts 25, Ben.
Yeah, Acts 25 is where Paul appeals to the emperor or to Caesar You know, in NRSV, it says the emperor. In KJV, it's Caesar. You know, those are at least synonymous in many ways in the Roman world. But he's first brought before Agrippa. And like I was saying earlier, these Romans, they're all struggling to figure out why everybody's so upset about Paul's teaching. You know, like all these different Roman officials have interrogated Paul. None of them think his teachings are problematic. And again, the message here might be that Christianity is no threat to Rome. Paul has had many times to express what Christianity is, and none of the Romans think it's a problem.
Ben, here in verse 13 of Acts 25, I actually wanted to go into Bernice, right? Berenice, Bernice. So Bernice, or as I think of it in Spanish, Berenice, comes closer to the original Ferenice or Ferenike, right? So here you have a name that means, like my name is Christopher, right? It comes from Christos Feros, right? The bearer of Christ.
Yeah.
Here you have the bearer of Nike, which is victory. That's the one with the swoosh on your shoes, right? That's, yeah. That's actually a Greek goddess, right? The goddess of victory. So you have the bearer of victory. Well, this is someone, it's an interesting figure, right? Because this is someone who could have, if anybody could have avoided the Jewish war, it could have been Berenice, right? And it's interesting to note that she is rumored to have had an affair with Titus at the same time, right? I'm expressing both these ideas that may even be contradictory, right? But she's rumored to have had an affair with Titus, who's the general who destroys Jerusalem and who later becomes emperor.
Mm, the plot thickens.
Yeah. So just wanted to bring her up and, you know, bring her into the conversation. Encourage those listening to look into, you know, some of these figures, right? That we have these people mentioned. Who are they, right? Who's Festus? We could have gone into Festus too, right? Just one last comment about chapter 25, Ben, and that's once again, you get this sense at the beginning of this chapter that the Roman authorities are interested in justice, right? But the Jewish leaders, they're just interested in killing Paul.
Right.
It's that contrast that we get between the two stories here.
In chapter 26, the conversation between Paul and Agrippa continues. Paul gives his account, the third and final account we get in Acts of his vision. This is somewhat different from the other accounts. So in this account, Jesus says a lot more to Paul than in the other accounts. In the other accounts, Paul gets instructions from Ananias. But in this one, those instructions come directly from Jesus. Again, we talked about how he could be telling this differently because of his audience. Maybe he thinks Agrippa needs to hear that everything that Paul heard came directly from Jesus, not from someone else. And maybe the other audience needed differently. Who knows exactly? We talked about the different reasons that these accounts could be different. But just wanted to point out that this is, in my opinion, another significant difference. You know, if someone says, Jesus told me this directly versus I went to another person and they said it to me, you know, I think that's a significant difference.
And we've covered, you know, some of the potential meanings of why the difference is, right?
So Paul then says, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. You know, this seems to be maybe an assertion about a divine calling. So previous accounts may not have emphasized that Paul had this divine calling enough. So in this account, the directive for Paul to preach to the Gentiles is coming directly from Jesus, right? Not through Ananias or not, you know, by some happenstance that he gets tired of preaching to the Jews and decides to go to the Gentiles, right? Jesus himself told Paul to go to the Gentiles in this account. And so that's much stronger, you know, statement about his calling, about his quote-unquote apostleship, we might even say, right?
Yeah. So in 22 through 23, we get, I'm going to read from NRSV, to this day I've had help from God, and so I stand here testifying to both small and great, saying nothing but what the prophets and Moses said would take place, that the Messiah must suffer, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. Now, the reason I highlight this verse, Ben, is I just don't know that the Hebrew Bible actually says this. I know you wanted to go into this too, right?
Well, that's what Paul is saying it is, right? That's his whole argument,
right?
Is that it is saying that. And if you would just listen to me, I would explain it, right? That's what Paul is saying.
Yeah.
Well, what stands out to me here is that statement. I mean, you read it, that the Messiah must suffer. This is a very key point for Christians that the Jews at the time, or even you know, now have a hard time accepting about the Messiah. The idea was that the Messiah wouldn't suffer. The idea is that Messiah was a leader that was going to, you know, unite the people and triumph over their enemies. Not that he was going to suffer and die, right? Yeah. So this is counter the popular narrative of who the Messiah was. And so Paul is coming along and saying, no, if you go back and actually look at the scriptures, they say the Messiah must suffer. And that's what he's trying to say, is that his renegotiation of these scriptures proves his point, not the conventional understanding of them.
I mean, he really is the first guy on the street corner arguing from the Bible, isn't he?
Yeah, it might be.
Yeah. So he's conflating again the suffering servant with the Messiah, right?
Yeah, at least within the Jewish mindset, you know, within Christianity, they're all within the person of Jesus, and it makes perfect sense for them to be all one person. And that's just difficult for the Jews, quote unquote, at least those that he are having a hard time believing him to accept, right?
Well, Ben, they're just stubborn. He argues persuasively, and they're the ones that are refusing to believe.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So then we have this interesting line, which is 26:28. Will you start us off with the KJV?
Yeah. So in the KJV, Agrippa says to Paul, "Almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian." Now, this is a statement that he makes to Paul. And the implication of it, when I read in the King James version of the Bible, is that Agrippa is saying to Paul that he believes his testimony, or at least all, you know, is being persuaded by Paul's testimony that Agrippa wants to believe him, right?
Yeah. It's like he's practically converted, is what he's saying.
He's just a dry Christian at this point, right?
Yeah. And so in the NRSV, we get rather, Agrippa said to Paul, "Are you so quickly persuading me to become a Christian?"
Yeah. And so here it's a question. And the word is quickly, translated as quickly, not almost. And in the context of the verses, as you read through, it's like a completely, to me, it's a completely different connotation here than the verses as it's translated in the King James Version.
And it makes more sense and looks more historical than the King James translator's version, which, again, could come from their theological or ideological commitment. It could come from their bad manuscripts. When I say bad, I mean compared to the ones available to the NRSV translators, right?
Yeah, and again, the implication of the King James translation to me is that Agrippa does believe what Paul is saying, whereas the NRSV clarifies,
or at least he's almost a believer, right?
Yeah,
he's getting there.
Yeah, and the NRSV clarifies to me, and when I looked at the Greek, I do agree. I don't know Greek, but I looked at the interlinear of this that actually went through the different words, and it, you know, explained their place
word by word, right?
Word by word, right? And it does look a lot more like a question, and the translation of the word quickly makes more sense in the context than almost. So the NRSV is clarifying that Agrippa is more amused here at Paul's apparent attempt to convert him. So it's almost like, Paul, are you trying to convert me to Christianity?
Yeah, I thought we were just having a conversation here.
You know, there's that metaverbal there that you have to get in that you don't get in the text, right? It's like, wait, are you trying to convert me?
Yeah.
Like, is that what you're doing? And he's almost like kind of amused at what Paul is
doing. It's kind of fun, isn't it? Yeah, I think it's a better reading. You know, grammatically, historically, contextually, right? It's just a better reading. And again, I don't know if it's because of an ideological or theological commitment on the King James translator's part, or just they just didn't have the manuscripts that we have. Remember, you know, we've talked about this, right? Even there were parts that they had no manuscript at all. And they use a translation, a back translation from Latin into Greek. So not an original Greek manuscript, but a back translation from Latin that was originally translated from Greek back into Greek.
Yeah, it just complicates it.
And that's what they did when they didn't have a manuscript at all. And when they did have manuscripts, they just weren't the best manuscripts, not the ones that we have available to us today. We have many more manuscripts than they did. I just want to say again, you know, the King James translators did a really good job with what they had. Their translation is excellent, you know, and the language itself. I mean, we had generations of Americans who are raised on King James Bible, right? On this is where we get our English. It's between King James and Shakespeare, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as it turns out, as we've gone through this, we've found, you know, not a few times where we have felt that the King James translation is actually better than the NRSV. So I don't think that, you know, it's completely out of style or discounted. I think overall NRSV is better, but there's still a lot of value in the King James Version translation.
Back to the language aspect, you know, if I'm memorizing a verse, I'm either memorizing it in the original, and then I'll probably give a translation off the cuff, right? Kind of like Oppenheimer did with I Am Become Death, Destroyer of Worlds, which is really just him giving a translation off the cuff of the Sanskrit he had memorized. Or I'll memorize King James because of the language.
Yeah. In chapter 27 is when Paul finally starts his journey to Rome. You know, he's appealed to Caesar. They've heard him out. They said, we don't get it. We don't think this is a threat to Rome. But he's already appealed to Caesar, so we have to send him. I don't know if that was a thing or not. You know, like, I don't know if they are really required to, or if they could have agreed to say, okay, well, let's just let it all go. But it helps in the narrative here to tell the story of how Paul gets to Rome to say he had to go because he appealed to Caesar. And there is some stark similarities here between Paul's journey on the ship, it travels on the ship, to what we find in the Odyssey with Odysseus. Thought that was interesting.
Yeah, you know, there are some similarities with the story of the Odyssey. I don't know if you want to go into those in particular. I think, you know, if you would mention them, I wouldn't be surprised if they're not the same tropes that you find in other literature too, right? Mm-hmm. The first thing that came to my mind was a story from Epictetus's Enchiridion, which is actually, it shows up again in more detail in Al-Kindi, the first Arab philosopher, Filosof al-Arab, they called him, the Arab philosopher. And so, you know, there are these common tropes of a sea voyage, right? So what are they, Ben?
Well, it's the sea voyage. It's the sort of foreshadowing or the portent of going to be a storm and they're going to wreck, right? But that there is one person on board that knew this is going to happen. And, you know, actually this happens a little bit in the story of Jonah, if you remember right. Like the storm is coming and the crew starts throwing cargo overboard.
Right, right.
And this happens all over in literature as well. So
yeah, I think you see some of these things in the stories I mentioned, but I think you're right. It's more closely aligned with the Odyssey and maybe even the Jonah story. And so it's kind of fun because I think it's another line that made me chuckle here. It's when Paul says in verse 26 of Acts 27, it's, let me just sort of paraphrase a little bit first, right? He's trying to tell them that everything's going to be okay.
Yeah.
But he says, but we will have to run aground on some island. Now, everything's going to be okay, but we have to run aground on an island, right? And then when they go to run aground on an island, they try to beach the boat and they end up dashing it on some reef or something, right? It's not clear what the Greek is actually saying there. One of the translations we get is a reef. But the point is they dash it to pieces on the rocks or something.
Yeah.
And they don't even make that landing. So everything's going to be just fine, except it's not.
Yeah, it made me think of like being in an airplane. And it's like there's a bunch of turbulence and somebody, you know, the captain comes over the intercom and says, everything's going to be just fine. We're going to crash land, you know, on this island here in the middle of nowhere, but everything's going to be just fine.
And then you don't crash land on the island. Yeah. You land in the water among the reefs,
yeah,
right?
That's right.
So then we have this fun other story that's sort of included here, right? That people are fasting. And again, this is another line that made me chuckle. Paul comes and says, today is the 14th day that you've been in suspense and remaining without food, having eaten nothing. Therefore, I urge you to take some food, for it will help you survive. No kidding, Paul. For none of you will lose a hair from your heads. Now, I have no idea what's going on here, but the line just made me chuckle, right? Because it turns out that eating keeps you from dying.
Yeah, it's...
Who knew?
I don't know exactly what's going on here either. They're fasting for some reason. Now, it does say, you know, it was like the time of fast, right? So this is some sort of holy time when they're supposed to fast. But the fact that they have been fasting for 14 days And it doesn't occur to them that, you know, part of the problem of why they feel they're going to die is that they haven't been eating anything. And Paul somehow pulls some bread out of who knows where when they had, you know, shipwrecked. The bread would not be still usable or good. How would it have been? Anyway, it's not clear to me how he has bread to eat.
Well, if he's pulling bread out of nowhere, that's a very Christian thing.
And that's the point, is that what could be going on here is that there's a miracle, right? That Paul is providing bread and he's breaking it, right? Giving thanks.
That too, yeah.
He gives thanks, that's breaks Christian it, and eats too. It. That's very Christian, right? That's
what's going Jesus on here. Yeah, that's what it looks like.
Uh-huh, and he's feeding them. And so that's definitely what could be going on. So this, Christopher, is where the story says that there were 276 people on the boat.
There it is.
I just thought was like a ton of people. I don't know how big this ship is, right? Now, there are other authorities, other texts, right? Other manuscripts that say it was just 76, which definitely seems more reasonable to me. But then I was reading commentary, I guess maybe some of the same commentary you were, that said, no, it could have been 276. That's totally possible. So I
or at know. Least they fit on the ship, yeah, right? That's, ships, it's possible, so, right? Yeah. But the question is, what's going on here, right? And sometimes when it comes to numbers, they have symbolic value. Sometimes it's just hyperbole, right?
Or other times it's a mistake of transcription, right? Like somehow that 200 got in there.
Right. I mean, maybe there's a squiggle before the 76 and it becomes 276 right. now.
Yeah, that can happen.
Well, I think that brings us to chapter 28, Ben. In chapter 28, we found out after they reached safety that they landed on Malta, which is an interesting. And again, for me, it was fun because I've been to Malta, right? Mm-hmm. That's another place I've been. And it is this pile of rocks, right? That's the funny thing about it, right? Is they're trying to land on a beach, but Malta is just a pile of rocks in the middle of the Mediterranean. Which, by the way, has a fun language that has something to do with Arabic. Yeah. Have you been there, Ben?
It's considered an Arabic dialect, I believe. Yeah.
Yeah, some kind of dialect of Arabic. Yeah.
I have not
today,
been there.
At least.
Yeah. I'd love to go.
Okay. Well, it's a pile of rocks in the middle of the Mediterranean. Don't miss it. It really is a fun place to visit. You'll see some mega yachts there if you go.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Like Monaco.
Yeah.
I mean, this was a place. It's actually interesting because it's in the middle of the Mediterranean, and so it's a refueling place. It's a place to, you know, to make a landing, to restock or rest or whatever, right?
Yeah, it's been strategically important for a long time.
Very important strategically, yeah.
So in verse 23, we have another instance here where it says that Paul is trying to convince them about Jesus, both from the law of Moses and from the prophets, right? So just another example here of where Paul is using the Old Testament or, you know, the scriptures to him, right? There's not any other scriptures at this point that are considered scripture to prove his point about Jesus. So renegotiation of the scriptures. Yeah.
Right. And so we have, once again, the result is mixed. Some were convinced by what he had said, while others refused to believe. But the funnest expression of that was the verse I keep quoting, right, that says, he argued persuasively, but they refused to believe.
That's right.
Which is kind of funny because it just sounds like if he argued persuasively, then they would be persuaded, right?
Yeah.
But they weren't persuaded. Maybe that's what it's trying to say. They were persuaded, but they were stubborn and refused to believe. So they pretended not to believe, right? They were trying to cover the sun with their finger. Does that even make sense in English? That's from Spanish.
It works. I mean, I haven't necessarily heard that, but that could work. You know,
this is an expression that comes from Spanish, Ben. Tapar el sol con el dedo.
Okay.
And it's the idea that you would sort of, just imagine if you put your hand up like you do to block the sun when you're talking to somebody and you want to look at them and the sun's shining in your eyes. But you do this to say, I don't see the sun. What are you talking about? There's no sun.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, so that completes the book of Acts. We're going to be getting into the actual letters of Paul here. Some of them authentic letters of Paul, some pseudonymous, right? But starting off with Romans next time, this is considered pretty authentic as it gets for a letter of Paul, right? This was actually written by Paul, so to speak.
Well, that's a good place to start. And of course, these are the earliest writings among the New Testament writings, right? So we've read earlier the Gospels and now Acts, but it turns out the earliest writings are from Paul. They're Paul's letters, or Paul and pseudo-Paul.
Yeah, the earliest writings we have. Yeah, we don't know if
there was
something before, but it hasn't survived in any case.
Yes, that's what we call the earliest extant writings.
Yeah, there you go. Okay. Thank you again, Christopher, for being with me for this.
Thank you, Ben. It's my pleasure.
Yeah. And we want to say thanks to all those who are participating in the project with us, helped us out with editing and social media stuff, and just being part of the group and the team. So we appreciate it.
Thanks also to our donors. We don't have a lot of expenses, but we are an all volunteer organization. Maybe that's why. We just have the expenses of the podcast hosting and whatnot, things like that. And so, but all that's covered, I think, by donations. Thank you for your donations. Keep those coming and keep your comments coming. We appreciate hearing from you. And we look forward to sharing with you again next week.
Have a good week.